everyone. This remote meeting of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee is called to order, and we will begin by taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Spudzinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bow.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Franson. Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Lippertz.
Present.
Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Munson, present.
And I believe Representative Stevenson will be joining us later.
Quorum is present. We have four bills up today, members, but I see that Representative Spudzinski has his hand up, so we'll start with Representative Spudzinski.
Hey, thank you, Chair Long. Just appreciate the committee this morning. Two quick questions for you, or just one, but just was kind of wondering, looking at the bills that are put on the table for today and then tomorrow, kind of wanted to just see where your budget bill is and then also your omnibus bill. Where are those things at? When can we expect to potentially see those, or just what your thoughts are?
Thanks, Representative Spudzinski. Good question. So we have gotten some guidance from leadership, and we will be releasing our omnibus bill on the Monday when we return from break, so April 5th. And then I believe, I don't think we have all of our hearing timing worked out yet. We're working with leadership on that, but we'll have a walkthrough, I believe, on the 6th, and then two additional hearing dates planned for amendments.
Mr. Chair, and just one last thing, you know, I would encourage you, if you have, you know, even something close to what you're thinking already, you know, if we had the Easter break to kind of digest it and talk to our constituents during that break, I think that might be a good thing. So I just encourage you, maybe drop it before we get through break, so we can have a little extra time to enjoy some extra reading while we're away. So
appreciate the suggestion. So with that, members, we will begin with our first bill, and that is Representative Christensen's bill, House File 1750. Representative Christensen, would you like to move that your bill be laid over? Representative Christensen, you need to unmute.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Christensen moves that House File 1750 be laid over, and I believe that you have an author's amendment, Representative Christensen.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's okay with you, I would like to ask Mr. Eloff to clarify the amendment. It's an extensive amendment, so.
Fine with me. Mr. Eloff, can you walk through the A2 for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really not as imposing as it looks. You can see that at the top of the amendment and in the middle of page one, there are new definitions of impacted facility and impacted worker, which are the subjects of the bill. So those are important and new. And a lot of the rest of the page and line numbers are the impacted facility is a new term, actually. So that had to be changed throughout the bill to match up with the new definition. And on page two of the bill, we can see that there is, as you'll learn when Representative Christensen goes through it, there's an advisory committee that's established to give advice to the new Energy Transition Office. And the language at the top of page two indicates a doubling of the number of members from the legislature that will be appointed to that advisory committee. It's now two from the Senate and two from the House. And in the middle of the page, page four, line 19, there's another representative to the advisory committee that's added from a representative of workers or employed by contractors at facilities that are scheduled to be closing. And finally, towards the bottom on lines 216 and 217, there's language that clarifies that Department of Employment and Economic Development will serve as staff for the advisory committee. That pretty much takes care of that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Elif. Any questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, Representative Christensen moves the A2 to get it in the shape she would like. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Christensen, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Elif, by the way, for clarifying that. So, Chair Long and members, House Bill 1750 is a bill that aims to enhance Minnesota's ability to support communities and workers that will be negatively impacted by the retirement of large investor-owned power plants. The city of Oak Park Heights in my district is one of these communities. I want to thank all the authors who've signed on to this bill, Representative Lislegard, Representative Meekland, Representative Igo. They also have communities in their district that are going to be affected. As this community knows, technology and market forces are driving the addition of more carbon-free and renewable resources to our system. As part of this transition, all of the state's largest baseload power plants, which have powered the region for decades, will be considered for retirement within the next 20 years. The transition will have widespread benefits, but unless we approach a transition collaboratively and proactively, it will also have deep impact on the cities that are that host the retiring power plants and the workers who've made their lives and careers working at the plants. To be clear, nothing in this bill would play any role in commenting on whether these plants should close or when, or what they should be replaced by. This bill simply seeks to help communities and workers who we know will be impacted by the closures. The bill has two major components: the creation of an energy transition legacy plan, which would incorporate the feedback of local government state agencies, and the creation and funding of an energy transition legacy office housed within DEED. And this office would provide ongoing support to the transitioning communities and workers. My testifiers today will speak to the needs of this bill and will help address and why it's inappropriate for next step to take the support to the communities that have helped power the region for decades. So first, I would like to introduce Mary Mayor McCumber from Oak Park Heights.
Mayor McCumber, welcome to the committee. You have to unmute, Ms. Mary McCumber.
Just saw it. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And Chair Long and members of the committee, my name is Mary McCumber, and I serve as mayor of the city of Oak Park Heights. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1750. Oak Park Heights has hosted the Xcel Energy's Allen S. King coal plant for more than 50 years. Although the plant's licensure was expected to go to 2037, Xcel's current integrated resource plan proposes early retirement as soon as 2028. Retirement of the plant will have deep impacts on our community. Property taxes attributable to the plant make up roughly 40% of our city's tax base, but the plant also has a major footprint in our community along the St. Croix River that will be one of the lasting legacies following this retirement. Many of you know that the St. Croix River has been designated as a national park by the Wild and Scenic River Act. Locally, we are working actively to plan for this transition. We have convened a local planning and advisory group to gather community input regarding the future use of the site, but carrying out that vision will take a great deal of coordination and support with an even broader range of stakeholders, including the state, some as say the DNR, Army Corps of Engineers, and others. But the more we work on this transition, the more complex it is. Different aspects of this transition touch multiple agencies, but the mechanisms for coordination and cooperation across state agencies currently does not exist. Moreover, existing state programs to support community development and displaced workers may not account for many of the unique and complex considerations that arise with transitions of this type or of this scale. The type of support that communities and workers need now is the type that it has that is best executed when it is approached as a team. This bill takes a massive step forward by the creation of a state transition plan and creating an office that will provide the ongoing work and coordination needed to execute that plan. The forward-looking collaborative approach in this bill recognizes that different communities will have different needs at different times and puts in place a structure to identify existing resources available to those communities, as well as the current resources and where they fall short. We know that from these transitions will be coming. We have the opportunity to get this right, but only if we have the right partnerships in place to see it through. Without a structure like the one laid out in this bill, communities will likely still be coming to the state for help, but without a defined role for how the state can help. Thank you to the committee for hearing this bill and to Representative Christensen and the co-authors on the bill for their continued support and being champions for communities like mine. And I will stand for any questions. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Mayor. Representative Christensen, would you like to introduce your next testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next testifier is Max Peters from the he is the Cohasset City Administrator and Vice President of the Coalition of Utility Cities.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peters.
Chair Long and members of the committee, my name is Max Peters, and I serve as the Director of Operations and Finance for the City of Cohasset. I also serve as the Vice President of the Coalition of Utility Cities, a group of eight cities that host the state's largest power plants and work collectively on the unique issues that our communities face. Cohasset is a city of around 2,700 in Itasca County and is home to Minnesota Power's Clay Boswell coal plant. Boswell is a coal-fired power plant with four coal generation units. Two of the four coal units retired in recent years, but as the committee is also aware, Minnesota Power has recently filed an integrated resource plan that proposes retirement of the final two units in 2030 and 2035, respectively. The Boswell plant has been an economic engine for our community. It provides reliable power to the entire region, supporting vital industries like paper and mining. As reflected in the community impact study conducted by the Center for Energy and Environment, the plant contributes around 69% of the city's tax base, 13% of the county's, and 19% of the local school district's tax base. If the Boswell plant were to close, those tax contributions would vanish essentially overnight. The plant also employs around 185 full-time workers, and many other jobs are supported by the activities at the plant. These are high-quality jobs that pay well above median household average in Itasca County and will be incredibly difficult to replace. Locally, we're doing everything that we can to prevent some of these impacts by diversifying our tax base and partnering with anybody who can help. So far, we have received great support from the state, Minnesota Power, and others. But the more we work on this transition, the more we realize that additional support and coordination is needed for both communities and workers to make the transition successfully. House File 1750 is designed to help our state create a roadmap for how to address these transitions while also putting in place the infrastructure necessary to carry out the transition. This is important work that the state can be doing now to ensure that any local government or worker that is facing a transition or will in the future will have the guidance and support they need. House File 1750 borrows concepts from other states that are actively working to address these same issues, but aims to improve upon them and make the most efficient use of Minnesota's resources by providing a central clearinghouse to coordinate work that we know will impact multiple communities and hundreds or thousands of individual workers. I'm happy to stand for questions. The Coalition of Utility Cities Legislative Consultant Shane Zahart is also on the line and available to respond to questions about the bill. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. We have three individuals who have signed up for public testimony, and given our full schedule today for all public testimony today, I'm gonna ask that folks keep to 2 minutes if you can. First, we'll begin with Jamie Fitzke. Welcome back to the committee.
Hi, thank you, Chair Long, Representative Christensen, and members of the committee. I'm Jamie Fitzke, Legislative Policy Manager for the Center for Energy and Environment. CEE is a nonprofit based in the Twin Cities with over 40 years of energy experience in research and development, program implementation, community outreach, finance, and policy. CEE fully supports House File 1750. a Minnesota Energy Transition Legacy Office, Advisory Committee, and Plan would establish and create a single point of contact for host communities, which creates efficiencies and opportunities to leverage coordinated assistance. Additionally, there are existing statutes and newly introduced legislation that include and affect stakeholders in host communities. House File 1750 creates the ability to connect these multifaceted aspects and stakeholders to become the central point of information and action. Much of our support for this legislation is derived from insights provided through the Minnesota Host Community Report, which is publicly posted and was provided to the committee. Following my testimony is my colleague who led the study, Ms. Audrey Partridge, and she will share some of her findings from the report and community conversations. Thank you, Representative Christensen and co-authors, for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you. Ms. Partridge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long, Representative Christensen, and members of the committee. As my colleague said, I'm Audrey Partridge, Manager of Regulatory Policy for CEB. I led the 2019 Minnesota Host Community Study with the support of the Coalition of Utility Cities. Through that study, we worked with six different Minnesota power plant communities facing retirements the coming years and several unions representing the men and women who work in and on those plants. We interviewed over 50 community leaders and workers, surveyed another 50 plus workers and community members, collected tax data, reviewed national case studies of plant transitions, and reviewed key Minnesota state policies. Through that work, I learned about the complex and multidimensional challenges communities and workers face as they work to transition through plant retirements. They will need to access assistance and funding from a variety of sources across a number of different governmental agencies and bodies and at every level of government, from local to federal. Currently, communities and workers are essentially on their own to discover and piece these resources together. A central office at the state level focused on assisting communities and workers, bringing resources together and coordinating between all the various important entities would provide communities and workers the support they need to tackle the challenges ahead and thrive beyond plant closures. This bill is an important step in supporting our communities and our workers, and thank you to the committee for considering the bill and to everyone who worked on it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And next we will hear from Rick Evans. Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. As you've heard from others, the impacts of plant closures is an important issue for the state of Minnesota. Utilities, local communities, organized labor, and others have been working on this issue since the announcement of plant closures started several years ago. The Department of Employment and Economic Development has already been involved in these efforts to address the issue. For example, Xcel Energy, the City of Becker, the trade unions, and Deed, among others, have been working for several years now on projects to grow jobs and promote economic development when the Sherco plants start to come offline in the next 9 years. This bill appropriately elevates the issue within the department and provides funding and structure to address it comprehensively for the state of Minnesota. The closure of fossil fuel plants occurs for the benefit of the entire state as part of a statewide effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So it's important that we meet the challenges presented to those by those closures with state programs and state funding through the department that has the responsibility and the expertise required. Xcel Energy supports House File 1750 and looks forward to working with Deed and the other stakeholders in this important effort that is promoted by this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and look forward to any questions if you have.
Thank you. There's no further public testifiers. We do have two amendments. So I think we'll turn to the amendments first, and then we'll take discussion to the bill. First, we have the A3 amendment. Representative Swazinski, is that your amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think the A4 would be Representative Mecklen's. I would move the A3 amendment. This is a pretty straightforward amendment. Obviously, a lot of the communities impacted that we know about are coal-fired plants, Oak Park, Granite Falls, and the rest. And this would potentially, obviously we hope that this doesn't happen. This bill doesn't have to be used. But if it is, we just wanna make sure that we're stating that it's to be focused on the coal-fired plants. Obviously you saw what happened in Texas. We need baseload energy. Natural gas is a good one. It sounds like even the EU is recognizing the fact that it's natural gas is sustainable, and they're looking to change the definition to include that. And so that we just want to make sure that we're just focusing this bill in a little bit and just remove references to natural gas. Thank you.
Representative Swazinski moves the A3 discussion. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. I agree natural gas is going to be a part of our energy mix in Minnesota for probably longer than the coal plants, but I don't agree with the amendment, and I would rather not accept the amendment because I don't want to leave them out of the picture here. They are a part of our, you know, energy producing mix, and they will continue to be for a while, but they deserve the representation. Those communities deserve access to this office just like everyone else does. So with that, I guess I'd say no, I would not like to accept the amendment.
Any further discussion of the A3? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 say aye.
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 All opposed? No.
No.
No. No.
The amendment is not adopted. Next, there is the A4 amendment. Representative Mecklen, would you care to offer the A4?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a quick question before I offer this amendment. There's mention of 8 cities that I believe I only have 5 on this amendment, and I would like to, if I could, make an oral amendment to include Granite Falls, Fergus Falls, and Hoyt Lakes.
Mr. Eliff, can we track that oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, could he give me those cities again, please, Representative Mecklen?
Granite Falls, Fergus Falls, and Hoyt Lakes.
Granite Falls, Fergus Falls, Hoyt Lakes.
Okay.
Does that work for you for an oral amendment to track, Mr. Eliff?
Yes. On line 1.3, after the second comma, insert Granite Falls, comma, Fergus Falls, comma, Hoyt Lakes, comma.
All right. Representative Mecklen, with your oral amendment, would you care to move the A4?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Representative Christensen for bringing this forward. I mean, it's not everything I would like to see, or maybe some more than it needs to be in some regards, but this is a very important issue. We've had this conversation for the last several years, and I really do appreciate her bringing this forward. I'll spare you the time of, but the city of Becker did include a letter of testimony. They weren't able to be here, but as one of their testifiers mentioned, you know, they've talked about 40 or 50% of their tax base. Well, for Becker, it's 75% of their tax base. So I really do support this. I hope you can support this amendment. It simply is identifying the cities that are impacted and putting that in the language. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Christensen.
Representative Mecklen offers the A4 amendment with oral amendment. Discussions of the amendment. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mecklen. When I came out with, and you maybe didn't see this before this amendment came to be, but my A2 amendment does clarify that we are covering all investor-owned plants in Minnesota. So the addition of these cities in particular is really redundant. You know, it's covered elsewhere in the bill. So I am not going to accept this amendment.
Further discussion of the amendment. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Chair Long. Again, I just want to reiterate what Representative Mecklen said. Representative Christensen, I really do appreciate this bill. It is very important. Obviously, Mr. Peters is here today. He, you know, city administrator of one of my communities, Cohasset. And it is very, very important. I think that we do put these cities' names in this bill. Again, you said it might be a redundancy, but it is important because this bill is going to do and serve these communities. So I would really strongly encourage that we could support this amendment and add this language to the bill. Thank you.
Representative Bissegarten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to Representative Mecklen. So you're in full understanding that the bill as presented includes all of the communities that your oral amendment is addressing.
I didn't say that. You know that?
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lizegard, I'm simply trying to get their name stated in the bill. And I also, since I'm here, I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call was requested from Representative Mecklen. Representative Lizegard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mecklen, I'm asking you a yes or no question. Do you understand that the bill as presented includes every city that you are naming in the bill?
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lizegard, I guess the short answer would be yes, I do get that. It's all investor-owned utilities. All I'm simply trying to do, Representative Lizegard, is to get the city's names included.
Representative Lizegard.
Okay, I will be supporting your amendment, but I think I'll say it, it's political that you want the names in there because the bill specifically addresses every utility-owned facility. So by naming it, you're trying to catch people saying that they don't support the communities. I don't like the political games, but I get what you're doing. So I will support it, unfortunately.
Further discussion? Seeing none and a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on the A4 and the chair votes no.
Vice Chair Akam.
No.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Aye.
Representative Bierman.
No.
Representative Bowe.
Aye.
Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Franson's excused. Representative Grunhagen.
Aye, yes.
Representative Hollins.
Nay.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Igo.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
Lee, no.
Representative Lippert.
No.
Representative Lizegard.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Munson.
Aye.
Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
There being 7 ayes and 8 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Discussion to the bill. Seeing none, Representative Christensen, would you care to make some closing remarks?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like Representative Lizegard has his hand up.
I'll go to Representative Lizegard and then back.
Okay.
Representative Lizegard.
Mine is just a comment to the author of the bill. Your heart and your passion for your communities and the people that work in these facilities is really demonstrated with your effort today. I've had conversations with you. I know that you have your family. It's part of your history. And when we spoke about it and you told me about you carrying this bill, I was moved. Real people get real results, and this bill is meaningful and it needs to move forward. And I thank you for your leadership on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Lizegard. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do think, the idea of this bill is good. I know Representative Christensen said that this doesn't say that we should be closing down. This is just the reaction. And, it's really sad. Actions have consequences and policy decisions have consequences. And the reason why this bill is before us is because the consequences are going to be bad for these families and bad for these communities. And it's not going to stop coal being burnt. It's just going to get burnt someplace else. And while we do want to have a energy system that's robust and efficient and affordable, we do need to clean up the mess that policies that are being pushed forward are going to create, and I do appreciate this bill that will do that.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Christensen, for bringing this bill forward. I don't have a question per se. I just want to really thank you for doing this. I think that those of us who are concerned with climate change are concerned because we care about people, and so this bill really gets to the heart of how these things affect the people who live in these communities. And we're really trying to take care of them as we move forward, addressing the fact that we need to do something to affect climate change, but knowing that this has disparate impacts on certain groups of people and we want to protect them as we move forward. So I really appreciate your efforts in this. And I just signed on as a co-author, so I'm excited to support this.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. I will add my support as well, Representative Christensen. You worked really hard for your communities and communities across the state. Last session, we were able to get through some funding for your efforts to help with transition planning. And I think this bill is a really important step forward to make sure we're doing everything we can to help communities with the transitions that we know are coming. And to Representative Swazinski's point, these transitions are coming regardless of policies we set. We heard from Great River Energy earlier this session that the reason that they're closing coal plants is economics. It is not cost effective anymore to operate a coal plant when you're comparing it to cheaper forms of energy like wind and very nearly solar. So these changes are coming to our communities and to our state as they are around the country. And I think this is a great effort to be able to plan for those communities to help support them as much as we can. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks so much to my testifiers and thanks committee for your support of this bill. I agree, it's a bill about workers and it's a bill about communities and some of these communities like Becker, as we talked about, the effects are devastating, 77% of the tax base. So thank you so much for your support of the bill. And I hope you can support HF 1750. Thank you.
Representative Christensen renews her motion and House File 1750 as amended is laid over. Thank you, Representative Christensen. Next, we have our second bill up, which is House File 1850. Representative Bierman, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 1850, and I do have an amendment as well.
Representative Bierman moves that House File 1850 be laid over, and you have the A2 amendment. Would you like to speak to your amendment, Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is thanks to the sharp eye of Mr. Eliff, and it's an amendment that just clarifies eligibility and capacity for the bill.
Any questions to the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to present and your attention to hearing bill at number 1850. This is a bill for a temporary tax credit for the purchase and installation of solar energy systems. And please take a look at the letter of support from Mencia in your packet, please. This tax credit will help Minnesotans across the state participate in our clean energy transition. Members, as we've heard in committee, we are behind as a state in our goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The more we do now, the longer the runway becomes to manage other sectors of the economic transformation that will take more time. Solar energy continues to drop in cost and is still a small slice of our current energy portfolio. Expanding our use of solar is a wise approach to procuring our future energy needs here in Minnesota. This bill is designed to increase the opportunity for all Minnesotans to have access to a solar systems rebate in every county of our state. Not everyone can participate in a program like Solar Rewards offered through Xcel Energy or Minnesota Power's Solar Sense. With this bill, every homestead, every farm, every business is able to apply and receive a tax credit on the investment of a solar energy system. It is a tried and true formula and good public policy. This program has helped spread solar across every county of Iowa. The program has historically sold out early every year, resulting in wait lists. In Iowa, this bill has generated hundreds of millions of dollars in local economic activity. If enacted here, we will create jobs across the state of Minnesota. Of course, saving home and business owners money on electric bills with a clean renewable resource is another primary purpose of this legislation. Typical system pays off in 8 to 12 years. The savings start immediately. It is an investment upgrade in one's home and property too, increasing property values. Offering this small tax credit is an added incentive that will encourage many more Minnesotans to make the energy investment in their future. State-level policies, like this bill, are instrumental in paving the way to a more sustainable, clean energy future. It is good for the pocketbook of all Minnesotans when we support less fossil fuels. This bill is good for the grid, it's good for the economy, and it is good for our environment. And the longer we delay in robustly addressing climate change from all angles, the more destructive and costly are the ramifications. Mr. Chair, I would like the committee to hear from a few testifiers as well, please.
Absolutely. First, we have Griffin Dooling. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Long. Thank you, Representative Bierman, members of the committee. I'm very excited about this bill. You know, we've seen firsthand in working with commercial and industrial customers across the upper Midwest, a lot of which are in agribusinesses and rural businesses, the impact that this program, a very similar program to what's proposed here, has had in Iowa on customers looking to install solar for their small business or their home. And I think it's really important to emphasize that this program, as Representative Bierman has designed it, is tailored to focus on small and mid-sized businesses and homes. This is not designed for super large-scale solar. It's not designed for solar gardens. It's not designed for utility-scale solar. It's designed to help individual businesses and homeowners install systems that can help them over the long term save a very significant amount of money. The average agricultural business that we work with can save over $200,000 over the life of a system from installing a solar array. That's very significant money in these communities in rural Minnesota and in agribusinesses where, you know, otherwise you often have challenges and issues to overcome with the way that the agribusiness economy has gone. And so this program will help make those projects more feasible for more farms, more homesteads in these communities that don't have access to some of the investor-owned utilities and other incentives that are available in those areas and in the metro areas. So we're very supportive of this proposal. We've seen firsthand the impact that it's made in our neighboring state of Iowa with nearly $300 million of private investment stimulated by this sort of program. And I think it can have a very similar and probably an even greater effect here in Minnesota, which will allow businesses like mine to create a lot of jobs and will help citizens in these rural communities access solar in a way that's more competitive and more fair when compared to their metro counterparts.
Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Micah Johnson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee. Micah Johnson, I'm from Solar Connection in Rochester, Minnesota. I've been doing solar for more than 10 years. Our company employs 25 people, all from greater Minnesota. They live in Rochester, Spring Valley, Hayfield, Byron, Plainview, et cetera. And I prefer to do jobs and systems in our home state of Minnesota, but I'm increasingly drawn by the demand to work in Iowa where there's a state tax credit. I approach solar very much from an economic and market perspective. We have no fossil fuels here in Minnesota. What we do have is plenty of sunlight. Sure, we're not Arizona, but we're actually on par with Houston and Miami for our levels of sunlight. I think it's well known that Minnesota sends $20 billion a year out of state for energy because we have no fossil fuels here. Imagine if we could just keep 5% of that in the state, just 5%. What could you do with $1 billion of economic activity? Imagine another $1 billion floating around the economy. And remember that dollars in the local economy circulate 7 times or whatever the research says. With that kind of boost, you'd be able to cut taxes and still pay for all the other stuff. This bill is designed for small scale solar, which by definition is more local and has much more local economic benefit compared to the large scale solar. When you drive by the utility scale solar construction sites, you see a lot of out of state license plates, largely because of our restrictive labor requirements pushed by the electrical union. But small scale solar is installed by local folks. All of my 25 employees live in Minnesota. As I mentioned, we have no fossil fuels here and hence very, very few fossil fuel jobs. But nationally, there are more solar jobs than jobs in coal or natural gas, and that trend will hold true in Minnesota as well. The thing to remember is energy transitions are nothing new. And again, I'm talking about the tax credit, not the transition stuff, but this is part of a transition. And just like our transition to the cell phone or the computer, this transition is going to happen whether we want it to or not. Those who are leaders in such transitions benefit from them, and those who are followers have to play catch up. And I'd like Minnesota to be a leader. A vote against solar is a vote to send money out of the state for energy. It's a vote against the Minnesota economy. It's a vote against Minnesota businesses. It's a vote against energy independence, and it's a vote against local jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And finally, we'll hear from Micah Cornea. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, committee members, and thank you for having me here today. My name is Micah Cornea, and I'm here representing All Energy Solar in support of House File 1850. All Energy Solar is a customer-focused local solar energy installer based in St. Paul. I am the inside sales manager for our company. We are the first line of communication when inquiring minds have questions about if rooftop solar is right for them. In my short 3-year tenure with the company, I have shepherded over 300 people into solar projects and have made more than 36,000 solar-related phone calls. I would consider myself an expert at connecting with Minnesotans about their fears as well as aspirations around energy security. House File 1850 would further expand solar rooftop access to residents and businesses in Minnesota who get their energy from co-ops and municipal power providers by way of a state tax credit. Let me tell you why. From the Northwest angle and the Arrowhead region down to the Twin Cities and Iowa border, people want solar. Unfortunately, for many Minnesotans outside of utility areas that offer rebates, the barrier to entry is greater. In parts of Minnesota, a common theme I hear from folks is that they are interested in solar, but there aren't incentives like there are in other places. I can't tell you how often I hear a co-op member ask me, does the state have any incentives yet? Our farmers and manufacturing communities are looking for ways to drive down operating costs. Energy storage is of particular concern for homeowners who tell me that when there is a power outage, they won't get power back for a couple of days. House File 1850 would be the kickstart many of our Minnesota friends need in order to take control of their energy independence and security. Furthermore, solar energy creates high-paying local jobs. Careers in renewable energy are amongst the fastest growing in the nation, and that's true here in Minnesota as well. We would love to open up an office outside the metro to more quickly serve solar demand there. This bill would drive that demand and create well-paying renewable energy jobs in communities outside the Twin Cities. By helping homeowners and businesses save money on utility costs, as well as creating local jobs in the communities they serve, this bill means more reinvestment of disposable income into local communities. The solar energy economy is not a Republican issue or a Democratic issue. It is a Minnesota issue, and All Energy Solar will stand in support of any legislation that benefits all Minnesotans. For these reasons, we are in support of House File 1850. Thank you.
Thank you. There's no public testifiers signed up, so we will move to member questions, and we'll begin with Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, this is a question for the testifiers. Do the people who install solar, do they pay anything towards the maintenance of the grid, of the electrical grid, with this tax credit or in general in any other way?
Looks like Mr. Dooling would like to take that.
Representative Grunhagen, thank you for the question. I think this is a very important question to raise. There's a few pieces here that are important to note. The first piece is that if you install a cogeneration system of any kind, whether that's wind or solar or any other technologies that are available, you do still have a fixed fee that you pay. It's typically called a meter charge, and that can range from $20 to even more depending on the size of the site. And so that goes towards the utility's fixed costs of service. Utilities in the state of Minnesota, particularly the municipal and cooperative utilities, also have the option to levy an additional monthly fee called the Distributed Generation Grid Access Fee to recover additional costs if they feel like that's necessary to make their service territory viable. And the other piece here that's very, very important to note that I think is often missed in this conversation is that all of the utility companies in the state, the cooperatives and municipals that work with an overall generation and transmission utility, a G&T like Great River Energy, are able to get reimbursed for the net costs of serving their member owners that have solar projects or wind projects from that GMT. So when you look at the overall cost impact of these investment decisions that individual homeowners or farms or businesses are making, that impact to the grid is ultimately spread across the millions of members that are served by the GMT, very similar to Xcel Energy. And so ultimately, the impact on any one individual bill is essentially negligible.
It looks like Mr. Johnson wanted to chime in as well.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. I've interconnected with, I last count, somewhere around 18 different utilities, and there's always a wide variety of ways that that's done, of course, but all of them have, of course, an application fee. Most of them have an interconnection fee. Some of those up around $1,000. And then there's always the aforementioned distributed access generation fee that is also levied by many utilities. And then anytime there is a grid upgrade, every single utility looks at their local distribution system and decides, is there a necessary upgrade to be done to have this? And anytime there is a grid upgrade, yes, it's the customer or the installation company, one or the other, or a combination thereof, that pays for that grid upgrade. Thank you.
Representative. Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that response. My concern is that, I don't have solar on my house. I live out in the country, and all I've seen is my electric bill grow from about 6.99 cents per kilowatt hour up to almost 12 cents a kilowatt hour. And I've tried to take every step I can to correct that. And so it just seems, I guess the question would be, is there an independent analysis of this bill that actually shows it would have negligible or no effect on other ratepayers who don't have solar? Because solar itself has been bailed out by other ratepayers with higher costs to maintain the grid. And that's not right, because a lot of those solar people who don't have solar are low income people who can barely afford their electric bill already. So is there an independent analysis done that actually shows, and you know, not that I don't trust your testimony, but each one of you make money off of this, and making money off something tends to warp a person's perspective at times. Not saying it's true, but that's been my experience. And so I'd like to see an independent analysis that this doesn't drive up the rates of people who don't have solar. Is there such an analysis on this bill? Thank you.
Representative Bierman, did you have anything? I see your testifiers would like to speak to it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as individuals go, again, certainly the individuals who get solar, and I would advise Representative Grunhagen, you know, if he's concerned about his electric bill, number one, you should get a quote from one of these individuals on what solar could do for you at your house to lower your electric costs. That'd be first and foremost. And I guess I'd let my testifier speak more to his overall point about those who don't have it and what that impact will be. They're specialists and know about this.
Absolutely. If we could be brief, because we just have a couple more minutes on this bill. Representative, or Mr. Dooling.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Long. Representative Grunhagen, that's a very good question. There's no study that I'm aware of on this particular specific bill that we're discussing today, but recently there was a study that was published by the University of Michigan, which evaluated distributed solar in a variety of different contexts across the country, and that study found that having a higher penetration of distributed solar within a utility service footprint can actually lead to a lower cost of service for that utility in many respects, because these systems that are getting installed reduce the peak demand that needs to be served by the distribution system. It reduces the individual customer's demand and overall offsets the need for expensive transmission upgrades and other distribution capacity upgrades within the area that's being served. And as Micah noted, this is also a situation where if an upgrade to the grid is necessary to service that customer who's installing solar, that is the customer's responsibility. And so that that specific expense is not spread across the neighbors or the other member owners in that area.
If you could share that study with us, we'll distribute it to the committee members. Mr. Johnson, and then we'll have to move on.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. It's a good one. I've done a lot of study on this. In addition to the Michigan Tech study or University of Michigan study that he's referencing, there's a variety of other studies out there. Happy to share them. And then there are some studies that show that, that distributed solar does raise rates for other folks. So there are studies that have gone both ways. The thing that I've found with those studies, and I appreciate your point about follow the money, right, is the ones that show that distributed solar raises rates for other folks are generally funded by fossil fuel companies or utilities. The ones that show that distributed solar does not raise rates for others or sometimes even lowers rates for others are usually done by independent parties. They're not done by solar companies. They're not done by solar people. They're generally done by universities or think tanks or people that, that aren't making money off of solar. So I think that's an important distinction to make. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Bierman, closing comments to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to appreciate the committee's time. Appreciate Mr. Eliff's help in that amendment, and I appreciate the testifiers being here present today with all the great information and the good questions from Representative Grunhagen. And I think Mr. Johnson's last point is important for all of us, not only in this committee, but in every committee. Source of information matters, and confirmational biases are tough for all of us to overcome sometimes. So look at the data, look at the source, and talk to people. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thanks again to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman renews his motion, and House File 1850, as amended, is laid over. Next, we have a bill from Representative Akam that's been posted to our website. Representative Akam, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Long and members, for the opportunity to present this bill that will develop small area climate model projections for Minnesota. We know our climate is changing. It's getting warmer and wetter. We know our changing climate is impacting industries and traditions, and we need to understand how these impacts will be felt at the local level. Communities all across our state need to be able to identify risks and vulnerabilities to their infrastructure so they can plan mitigation strategies to become more resilient. This bill leverages expertise and programs at the University of Minnesota, including the Minnesota Supercomputing Institute and Extension Service. They will work together to produce Minnesota-specific data that will enhance and accelerate the ability for Minnesota communities to understand and prepare for the future climate risks that matter most in all corners of our state. This morning, I'm joined by Dr. Heidi Roop from the University of Minnesota Department of Soil, Water, and Climate, who will go into detail about the climate model, the implications, and the community engagement it will provide. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Roop.
Dr. Roop, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Great. Thank you for having me. I will just share my slides here. Of course, the scientist comes with slides. Chair Long and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to be back and join you to discuss this important topic. My name is Dr. Heidi Roop, and I am an assistant professor of climate science and also an extension specialist at the University of Minnesota. I've had the opportunity to share with you previously about the risk that climate change poses to our state, to our residents, the economy, industry, and of course, to our future well-being. And I've also had the opportunity to talk to you about the drivers of this change. Today, I'm here to talk to you about this critical need, key need for our state as we look towards really understanding how it is that we manage and craft effective, fiscally responsible solutions to future climate risks. Those are risks we are all going to face across the state, and we critically have the expertise in-house to develop and deliver highly sought after and requested Minnesota-specific climate information, the technical support, and critically the capacity building opportunities that will really help accelerate our ability to understand and prepare for changes in climate that we know are coming down the line. Of course, it's no surprise, this has already been discussed today in this hearing, that climate is changing. We are seeing changes on a global scale, and of course, changes on a local scale. Minnesota, our average annual temperature has increased by 3 degrees Fahrenheit, and we expect this warming to continue on into the future. And with this warming brings impacts, to our landscapes, to our communities, things like warming winters, flooding, changing in our lake waters, the presence of cold water fishes, extreme precipitation. Essentially, climate change is everywhere, and it is changing. We also then have to understand, what does the future hold? Our actions today largely determine the extent and magnitudes of the changes that we expect. This plot, which you've seen before, shows observed changes in temperature in green since 1900, with different projected changes, so modeled data changes, based on different emissions pathways. So what will happen under high emissions of greenhouse gases, and what might happen to Earth's temperature under low greenhouse gas emissions pathways. These scenarios of future temperature have a large spread because we don't know what society will do in regards to emissions reductions. So while there is inherent uncertainty in climate models, and of course in what the future holds, the greatest source of uncertainty, where we land on this curve, is the potential for human behavior. Essentially, what will we do or what won't we do? So we can capture well the physics of Earth's climate system in our models. We don't, of course, have the same skill in predicting human behavior. Climate models and the use of different emissions pathways offer us the best tool or source of information that we have for understanding these potential pathways. And of course, models and projections are widely used to inform decisions today. Beyond climate scenarios and projections, we've used, where many of us have been accustomed to looking at projections on a near daily basis and using them to inform critical decisions around the management of, say, a global pandemic or our retirement portfolios or population density. So say this example, we don't have 100% certainty of a given outcome or action, but scenarios like this of projected deaths from COVID-19 that are produced by the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation are important for informing our decision-making. Of course, they are fundamentally different from a climate model in their inputs, their outputs, their uncertainties, and their predictive capacities. The similarity, however, is that these models seek to incorporate observed patterns and trends and then represent complex systems that involve human interactions and behaviors in a tool to inform decision making. This is what a climate model does. In fact, a quote from IHME about this tool reads, quote, "We aim to help policymakers plan for the days and the months ahead and to take action to change the course of the pandemic for the better. We have developed three different scenarios that can help policymakers understand how different decisions, along with the availability of vaccines, could help affect or how those could affect the trajectory of the pandemic in their location." So with future climate change projections, we aim to achieve much the same. We use the best available information and observations and science to provide scenarios that help policymakers and communities understand the trajectory of climate change and its impacts, so decisions about climate risks can be made to help change the course for, quote, the better. Of course, climate data are already embedded in a range of our decisions today. Of course, the types and scale of the decision in both time and space influence the information we'll need, and we'll cover that a bit in a subsequent slide. But essentially, we are already using climate information in systems and in resources that we manage and rely on every day. Observed climate data are used to inform infrastructure design, how we manage our stormwater, when we plant crops, how we design railways, how we assess the risks of the presence of infectious disease. And so we are already accustomed to using climate-related information in decision-making. But we also know that the past climate is no longer the best predictor of our future climate. So here's an example. Minnesota, as Representative Akam has already mentioned, is getting warmer and wetter. These data show us the change in 20th century average precipitation and warmth over time. In the upper right quadrant here are data points that represent the years that had both above average wetness above average wetness and warmth. And we can see that the 10 combined warmest and wettest years have all occurred after 1997. This is just one set of data that is telling us about this change, the direction of the change. And the question is, what information do we need so that we can better understand these changes and then prepare for them? Climate change with any of these projected changes in any of these models, there are typical ups and downs, and they'll be superimposed over this changing trend towards, say, warmer, wetter conditions. That is to say, we're still going to have dry seasons or years within predominantly wet decades. We're going to have floods during periods of drought. We'll have cold extremes during warm winters. Just as there are years on that plot that were warm and wet or wet and cold, We see from observed data that the baseline is shifting. Climate change essentially induces a shift in the mean or the average conditions and shifts us towards more extremes, like this plot is showing you. And this is all relative to what we sort of, our lived knowledge, our experience over the last 120 so odd years. And of course, part of this is the fundamental difference between weather and climate. Climate is analogous to, say, your personality, and weather is more like your mood. One can change on a daily basis and is much harder to predict, say, for by your family members or your partner. What side of the bed are you going to wake up on? However, your personality is less dynamic. It's sort of mostly fixed, but of course, changeable over time. With climate change, we are in effect shifting the personality of the climate system. It will still remain moody, and we won't be able to tell you what mood it will have on a given day. So the point here is that we need to work to understand the shifting personality in our climate system and its range of mood swings. But when it comes to planning, broad scale statements like it's getting warmer and wetter are insufficient for helping folks like yourself who are actively trying to make decisions about real world things that matter to people that also cost money. And so we need to make concrete investments in also in providing information that helps us make better decisions, or at least provides that foundational knowledge to inform those decisions. So the fundamental question with climate change is not, is it getting warmer and wetter? It's how much warmer, how much wetter, and what do I plan for in my community or my district for a specific project or asset or for a specific natural or cultural resource? Our state lacks this type of information. It's not easily accessible where it does exist, and we have the ability to generate more accurate and precise climate projections. So climate models, this is a kettle of fish. We have excellent climate modelers if you really wanna get into the weeds, but climate models are our best source of information that we have right now. They're a critical tool in our toolbox, but not all models are created equally. And we have the ability in Minnesota, those resident in-house expertise, to try to generate and use models that will best capture the conditions here. Currently, there are 40 global climate models. So these are models that simulate global conditions. They are generated around by 10 different nations, and they're widely accepted and used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the United Nations, and in other assessments, including those national climate assessments in the United States. There is a new generation of climate models coming online right now as we speak, and they're actively being released and actively being used and validated for the state of Minnesota. I would be remiss if I didn't note that, of course, there are various difficulties in projecting future climate. We do not have a crystal ball. Climate models work to represent complex interactions between the land, the atmosphere, the ocean. We do this for various different scenarios based on greenhouse gas emissions. But nevertheless, the major forcings that drive climate are well understood, and the state of the science is progressing rapidly, and we have data to demonstrate that our models are performing based on what we're observing. We've been modeling that long enough now that we can say, well, how well did the model perform against what we've actually experienced? And here's an example. This is an example of comparing data collected by NASA observational temperature records compared to an ensemble mean. So multiple models, we run multiple models and we can average them together to try to capture the range of conditions and not skew our results one way or another. And this plot basically shows you that while there are uncertainties with climate models, they have successfully reproduced what we have lived over the last 50 years. So we are testing our models constantly. We are using observational records to see if and how well they're working or not. And we have rigorous methodologies for assessing all of these different types of models.
Dr. Roop, if you could just begin to wrap up.
Yep, you got it. So you may be asking, well, you're a climate scientist. You want these data. This is in your own interest because this is what you do. And I want to just let you know that there are people who want this information. The answer is yes. The state recently conducted a survey, and there is broad cross-sectoral demand for this information. 80% of over 200 respondents said this type of information was very to somewhat important to their work, while only 1% said this information was not important at all. Applications that people communicated that they would use this spanned everything from water management and agriculture to infrastructure design and community engagement. So in addition to high demand, we have researchers, nonprofits, and the private sector all having applications and need for this information. But critically, it has to be produced at a scale that's useful. So most global climate models produce information at around 62 models per 62 miles per grid box. Again, that's not very helpful when we start thinking about sort of infrastructure or asset specific questions. So we also have really complex climate here in Minnesota, and we know that we can capture this well in what is called a regional climate model. These regional models use global climate models, but take into consideration regional patterns of variability and add things in like the Great Lakes and lake waters, which, as you know, in Minnesota are critical for understanding our climate. This is an example of a projection that is generated for Minnesota. This is looking at snow days. So these are projections of change in the number of days of snow exceeding 1 inch. This is an output from a regional climate model. This is generated by researchers at the University of Minnesota for a water resources related project. And they can help us better understand not only the change in the pattern, but where it's going to be most prudent to start considering what the impacts of, say, changing numbers of days of snow cover might have. There are parts, as you can see, as we march towards the future. So on the far right, we're looking at the end of the century under high emissions, our current emissions. You can see there are parts of the state, the white is no statistical difference. There are places in the state where it's not really going, to the best of our knowledge, matter, because there's not going to be a significant change over the observed period. But in some places, it's going to be very prudent to consider how you might plan for more freeze-thaw cycles or deepening frost in your farm fields, because the information we have available to us to help better inform our decisions. So finally, of course, we need more than the data. The data are one piece in our toolbox. We need to be able to provide the technical services, the capacity. People have to be able to use this information and use it well. And in order to do that, we have to provide support for understanding what are the uncertainties in these models. How is it appropriate to use or not use this information in planning, right? So we need to provide those technical resources and capacity. They go hand in hand with the data themselves. And then finally, I just want to thank Representative Akam for drafting this bill, and to you all for considering this opportunity that we have to add critical knowledge to our state's risk management toolbox. I really think it will be of benefit, and I hear every day from cities, from counties, from individuals who are looking for this information and looking for the technical services and support to use this information in their investments and understanding of their future climate risks. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Roop. We have a few minutes for questions, if any members have any. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to disagree with quite a bit, or have quite a few concerns. You know, I noticed, Heidi, you said it's going to get wetter and warmer. Well, the computer models a few years ago said it was going to get drier and hotter here in Minnesota. So, I mean, we look at the computer models in the past, they have a lot of errors or outright lies. And I don't have a lot of credibility with the IPCC, which seems to manipulate the data just to get more tax subsidies or more money for their organization. I would like to send you a book written by three eminently qualified scientists, Why Scientists Disagree with Global Warming. And I think you need to read that, because it's easy to believe a lie you've been told 1,000 times and the truth the first time you hear it. And it sounds like you need to read both perspectives, not just one. The problem is, like Inconvenient Truth, that movie should have been renamed Inconvenient Lies. And there needs to be a consequence for this. And the computer models are only as good as the people who put money or put data in. And so often those people are looking to be subsidized with tax dollars. So I just encourage you to read outside your circle of influence. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, I'll just ask that you please not attack any motives of individuals who are testifying in front of the committee. I think we can ask questions about data and science without getting into why people are doing the work they're doing.
I just questioned her information she shared. It's only one-sided.
Dr. Roop, briefly.
Thank you, Chairman Long, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for that question. I would be more than happy to read whatever documentation you'd like me to read. I feel strongly that I do consider all sides of the science. I interact with and read the literature that goes through rigorous peer review processes, but you're most certainly right. In today's society, we are fed information often with an echo chamber, so I'd be more than happy to consider and pass a critical eye by the information that you have and, of course, entertain a conversation. I will note that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessments to date, the climate models themselves for key things like sea level rise have actually been underestimating the observed patterns of change. And there's a common misconception that the models themselves are biased towards exaggerating, say, the effects of carbon dioxide. And of course, that uncertainty can go either way. But we actually see these models being skewed towards, we're basically underestimating the things that we are actually seeing surface on the landscape. So in many ways, people are critical on the other side of the IPCC and saying that they're not doing enough because they're not capturing that high end well. And so climate models and the science will always be an iterative process that evolves. And I think you're right, we always need to consider more information and all the information. And I feel confident that the information we do have today will inform, help us make better decisions than we could make in the absence of information.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, quick comment.
Very, very quick, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Heidi, send me your email with your address and I'll send it to you. And Heidi, this isn't against you personally. I know you mean well, but so much of the global warming climate change scam is about sucking tax dollars, and they manipulate the data in order to justify that. Read the book and see if you can see a different perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I will definitely reach out to you. And yes, thank you very much. And we will be in touch.
Sounds like there can be a constructive dialogue to be had. Representative Akam, any closing remarks to your bill?
No. Well, just in that, I would like to thank Dr. Roop for joining us today and the expertise she brings to this conversation. I think we, having science and data to base our decisions as policymakers is really important. And so I think that this bill and this climate model is very important. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'm done.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Next, we are hearing Representative Lee's bill, House File 2386. Representative Lee, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the informational hearing on House File 2386. Mr. Chair and committee, we have heard a lot of discussion in this committee, this session, about the many benefits we can achieve when we make smart, targeted investments in our energy system. And as all of you know, in 2020, my district, along with many other experienced and incredibly challenging crisis, the killing of George Floyd and the ensuing civil unrest was and is a traumatic experience for my community and all those communities that were involved. As our communities work to heal and recover, we are thinking carefully about how we can rebuild in a way that best position our residents and businesses for success. The central role that energy plays in our economy cannot be overstated. For homes and businesses struggling to make ends meet, energy waste contributes to higher electricity bill, which means that money can't be spent on, you know, putting food on the table for struggling families or for businesses that are trying to stay afloat and pay their employees. Meanwhile, clean energy and energy efficiency jobs remain a source of new jobs and economic development for communities throughout Minnesota. And so I think that this is why this proposal is needed for us as we rebuild. The bill will establish a grant program to support homes and businesses struggling with this recovery. The bill establishes a competitive grant program designed to allow community stakeholders to have meaningful involvement in the decision-making process and prioritizing funding for projects and proposals that best integrate workforce diversity, equity, and the needs of under-resourced communities and really prioritizing community outreach success. As drafted, the bill would allocate up to one-third of any appropriation to serve residential customers, with the remaining portion available for sustainable energy efficiency enhancement in commercial and multifamily buildings. Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers that I've been working with, and also I believe there are some public testimonies too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. First, we will be hearing from Matt Kaczynska. Please proceed.
Oh, thank you so much, Chair Long and members of the committee and Representative Lee. Appreciate you having me here. Can you hear me okay?
Cool. Yes, we can.
Thank you. So I said my name is Matt Kazinka. I represent the Lake Street Council. We're a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis. I really appreciate being invited to offer my testimony today in support of the Rebuild Right Grant program. The perspective I'm going to share is one that's been informed by the work that me and my colleagues have been doing in the past 10 months to support small businesses that were impacted by the civil uprising that followed the murder of George Floyd last summer. Lake Street Council exists to support the businesses and organizations in Lake Street, which is a 6-mile commercial corridor that runs through some of the most diverse neighborhoods in the state. We estimate there are about 2,000 businesses within our corridor, the vast majority of which are very small businesses. The street has been a home to immigrants for over 100 years, starting with Scandinavian immigrants in the late 1800s, followed by groups of Greek and other European immigrants who helped define Lake Street as a premier commercial corridor. And their legacy has continued today with the help of newer immigrant families from Latin America, from East Africa, along with the Black, Indigenous, Asian, and white families and business owners that make Lake Street what it is today as a fantastic, diverse place. One of our roles as an organization is to identify where resources are or aren't reaching members of our community. And through outreach, communications, and direct support, we make sure that all businesses have a fair shot of success here. Our work shifted very dramatically, as you can imagine, last summer, when the events of the summer resulted in hundreds of damaged businesses in our corridor. We're very lucky that Lake Street is a place that people love and feel passionate about because soon after the events, we were able to raise nearly $11 million from tens of thousands of individuals to support businesses in crisis. While that fundraising far exceeded our expectations, it also only begins to meet the need. So far, we've deployed about $7 million in grants to over 365 businesses and nonprofits in the corridor, and we're working on additional investments to support the upcoming phases of recovery. I want to share with you a little bit of the data drawn from the grant applications from 420 businesses that applied for funding. I think it provides a substantial, although not fully complete, view of the scale of damages in the corridor. The businesses that were damaged by the unrest were small businesses. Over 85% employ 10 or fewer people at their business. But taken together as a whole, the folks who applied for funding from us employ over 1,700 full employees and 1,200 part-time employees. These were local businesses. Over 2% of them have Minnesota-based ownership. They were very diverse businesses. 82% of the businesses are owned by someone who identifies as Black, Indigenous, as a person of color, or as an immigrant. These businesses were really dependent on the availability of affordable rental space. Although many of them have operated in the corridor for years, and in some cases decades, over 85% of these businesses that were impacted are renters in their space of operation. And then finally, these are folks that are operating without much of a safety net. Over 55% of the businesses reported that they or their landlords did not have any form of insurance that covered the damages that occurred. Many of them, even if they did have insurance, reported only partial coverage or flat out denial. Aside from insurance, for those who had it, 73% of applicants stated that they could not access any other forms of support for their recovery other than the grant that we were able to provide, which maxed out at $25,000. We learned through our grant that damages were extremely significant, extending far beyond the financial support that we have. 90% of businesses reported damage to the building, and 80% of them reported losses of inventory or equipment from theft or damage. In total, the applicants reported over $38 million in needs to fix their damages and become whole. And I'll say that now, 10 months later, after much of this data was covered, we know that's an undercounting of the need, especially when considering the prospect of rebuilding dozens of buildings that burned down. I'm proud of the work we did. I think we helped contain some of the worst outcomes and accelerated the recovery process. And we see that businesses are doing their best to get reopened. But so many remain closed, especially those who operated one of those dozens of buildings that were destroyed. A lot is left to be done to set the future of this corridor and of the sites that were destroyed and need redeveloped. So from our perspective, if we're going to ensure that the recovery is equitable and that the folks who called Lake Street home will be able to continue calling it home, that we need more resources to be put on the table. So we support this bill in part because we think it offers a really key opportunity to advance Lake Street's recovery by building energy efficiency and renewable energy into the recovery from the start. And we think it helps put vital resources where they are needed in this moment. We have worked a lot with energy efficiency. We know it makes sense for small businesses. For the past 6 years, we've worked with Energy Smart, which is a program of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, to help hundreds of businesses in the Lake Street Corridor get free energy assessments and technical assistance. Dozens of those businesses, we help them find ways to tangibly reduce their energy bills through new equipment, which both reduce their operating costs and help them be able to serve their customers better. And, you know, move that money that they were spending on energy into other investments in employees and their families and into equipment. While energy is often not at the top of mind of small businesses, I do believe it's a critical part of the recovery. First of all, we know that these businesses are going to be purchasing and installing equipment that was damaged or destroyed, and that equipment often has an energy component. About one third of our applicants to our grant told us that they were seeking assistance to buy new equipment, and whether they're replacing a single AC unit or a full building HVAC system in a new building, there's going to be opportunities for them to choose something about efficiency and renewables. They're also, these businesses are really going to need help addressing deferred maintenance. In our experience, larger efficiency projects take years to get done. Many businesses need time to save money and plan the project, you know, set aside the capital to replace equipment. Unfortunately, most of these businesses that have went through this event put any savings they had into reopening and redeveloping. And so they don't have an emergency savings to go to anymore. And deferred maintenance is going to be a bigger problem than ever. And it already was a problem. Finally, these businesses have significant barriers to access energy resources, even before all of this. Businesses who operate on a subsistence basis, who navigate the system with English as a second language, who rent their space, they're already much more likely to be using older, inefficient equipment, and they often did not know that there are choices to be made that could help them save money on their energy bills. This program can not just help address the current crisis, but also focus resources where they've been needed for a long time to help address these inequities. We've learned what works and doesn't work in programs like this. And in general, a one-size-fits-all approach we find does not work very well. This program allows for the development of flexible, community-based approaches that could overcome the significant barriers for small businesses. From my perspectives, in order for businesses or programs like this to be successful, they need to be founded on partnerships with trusted local organizations and individuals. Business owners are getting pitched on stuff all the time, and a way to get in the door and actually make change with them is to work with someone they trust, they go to for support, like a local business association or a local chamber. These programs also need to be easy to participate in. Even before all of this, I found it was really hard to get a business to focus on energy because it was way, way down the list of things that they were needed to address as more urgent crises. Now they're going to need even more help to be able to work through the complexities of utility rebate programs. And finally, the programs are going to need to figure out how we address and reduce upfront costs as much as possible avoid asking businesses to take on new debt. Even prior to this, small businesses were strapped for cash, overloaded in debt, often willing to compromise value for the sake of affordability. If we want them to choose energy efficient equipment that's going to save them money in the long run, it needs to be also cost competitive up at the point of sale. I just want to close by saying that people in my community are worried that Lake Street and the many other needs like it that were also impacted by the unrest last year are at risk of losing the small family-owned businesses that made it special. Any targeted activity to help these businesses make it through this crisis, and not just make it, but reduce their ongoing cost perpetuity through better equipment and energy efficient and renewable energy, is going to help them and help Lake Street continue to be what it has been for generations as a small business corridor. We know folks want to stay here. They want to reopen. This program gives them one more tool to stay in the game. So Chair Long and committee members, I want to thank you for your opportunity to share my perspective, and I'll be available for questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Lee, would you mind if we skip the public testimony, given how short we are on time, so that we can have time for questions?
Mr. Chair, if possible, can we just get the passer to a minute or two, and then we can go to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Pastor Rasmussen, if you could speak briefly. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Long. My name is Ingrid Rasmussen, and I serve as the lead pastor at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in South Minneapolis. I also serve as a board member for an organization called Longfellow Rising, which is a collective of business owners, nonprofit leaders, and other stakeholders. that were affected following the unrest. Longfellow Rising includes a number of owners of properties that were damaged or destroyed. Many of them, as we've heard, small businesses owned by people of color. From the beginning, we have prioritized the redevelopment of both relationships and the built form to be equitable and environmentally just, and to ensure that what is created brings this sense of cultural vitality and belonging back to our neighborhood. Our collective of property owners and community members is about to begin defining specific goals for energy use and performance. Having grant dollars available to us would help us to go further than standard level development. As you well know, creating buildings that use energy efficient and regenerative technologies can often cost more to build, but they are less costly to operate, saving businesses and nonprofits significant dollars over time. The Rebuild Right grant program would offer members of Longfellow Rising, my community members, my neighbors, the opportunity to bridge that gap of first costs and help us realize our goals of creating buildings that serve community members well. The application requirements seem reasonable to us. We would ask that you would ensure that the application process and reporting requirements don't become overly time consuming or burdensome. We appreciate the priority placed on businesses owned by women and people of color and the commitment to employ contractors that pay a fair wage. We also appreciate the 4-year time frame of this grant program, as it will take time for these designs to be developed, especially understanding the importance of the broader community that we want to engage in the decision-making process. Thank you for your consideration of this program. The need of affected property owners is great. There is a real opportunity here to rebuild in a way that is better for business, better for community, and ultimately better for our planet. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll turn next to member questions, and we'll begin with Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be for Matt Kanzica. Did I get that right?
Close.
Close enough. Kazinka.
Kazinka. All right. Sounds good. I rarely get anyone who gets my name right. So feel the pain, man. Anyway, just a quick question to you. What conversations have you had with the administration? Obviously, the state, as the Lake Street Council, the state is going to be getting billions of dollars that sounds like the legislature does not want to have to spend. They want to leave it up to the administration to spend. Have you had any conversations with the administration in hopes of capturing some of those dollars for redevelopment costs in the city and on Lake Street? And then I have a follow-up. Thank you.
Mr. Kazinka.
Thank you, Chair Long and Representative. I apologize, I won't be able to speak to that fully. Our executive director may be engaged in some conversations with coalition partners who are working to support this recovery effort, but I am not familiar with those conversations if they are occurring myself, so I apologize.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, we have had some conversation with the administration and even our federal delegations to see what can be spent at the federal level for any kind of unrest recovery. Right now, as you may know, there's no guidance yet from Treasury, and so we're still waiting for that information, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just think in general for a vast majority of these programs, you know, we should be looking at returning ratepayer money back to ratepayers that's in the RDA fund. And if there are federal dollars available, using those dollars for these types of projects. We had the big polar vortex, and it was generally understood that those are large costs, that just return it back to the utilities in the form of and tell them to rebate the money. I think those would be good uses for a lot of these funds. And then if there are printed fiat dollars at the federal level that come to the state, utilize those for some of these projects, just from a funding mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Representative Lee, closing remarks to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to note, you know, to that point that, you know, these residents and businesses are, you know, ratepayers and in the system too. And so, you know, we really need to consider what are the different options that we have. And that's why I have requested the chair to hear this on an informational basis so that we could really look at what are the different options that we have available. And Mr. Chair, really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, hear from the public about the great need that we have. It's almost a year and we haven't really taken any steps at the state. I know that in the House we have, you know, throughout the special session, voted for the Promise Act that Chair Norris is carrying a few times, but there's been inaction in the other body. And so I hope that this year we could get something done. And thank you for the consideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward, Representative Lee. And I think this is a really common sense way if we're going to be using the renewable development account for its purposes, which is to help develop renewable energy and energy efficiency, then targeting them to the communities that need it and that can use it. And particularly when we know that so many of these businesses are rebuilding right now, makes a lot of sense. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. Members, we're out of time for today. We will be meeting again tomorrow. That's our last meeting before the break at 10:30. And so we will see you tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.